Welcome to the second episode of Life Dunk. If you missed the first one, which was called The Rabbi and the Shrink, you can catch up. This one is about control, whether we have control. And Dr. Mark Brelovitz, who's with us here today, rather wittily called it, what did you call it, Mark?
Trying to decide, well, can you decide whether or not to sink or swim?
And also with Mark, we have Rabbi Miriam Berger.
Good morning.
So, rabbis and therapists often see people when things are tough. And we're going to talk about when life doesn't go quite as well as we want it to in this episode. So, start off with you, Miriam. You've been a lot of being a rabbi is being with people when things are hard and when out of control. We're in a very rationalist society which likes to believe we can control things. How do you help people through when they realise maybe they're not the masters of the universe that they thought they were?
So it's an interesting idea, right? Because I think we live our lives with that sense of being in control. And particularly, I would say, you know, it's quite a middle class affliction that one thinks that with a good enough education behind us and with enough money behind us, that we can control things. And certainly when things start to go out of control, we know how to fix them. You know, have you ever seen a Jew of a certain age go to a doctor that isn't the top consultant? Do any other type of consultants exist? Because, you know, they have to know that they're seeing the person who will make this okay. Or, you know, younger people who might be totally obsessed with playing the system to get their children into the right school. It feels like a lottery. It feels like something out there that is beyond our control. But there's something about playing the systems and therefore taking back control. So I think there's both the buzz of feeling like you're in charge, and then when it goes wrong, those big kind of questions of, well, who can fix this? I need to find the right doctor or the right school or the right friendship group. This is going to put me back in control. Or who can I blame? Because that's a helpful one. Maybe it's the marriage, the boss, the bully, society. You know, and then ultimately that falling into the question of why me? And the sense of injustice when life feels out of control. And I feel like that's the challenging spot. That's the moment that people need that support of, do they latch onto something desperate to control, or do they submit and say, actually, what will be, que sera, sera, and allow themselves to kind of be a puppet in their own lives. And I realise that neither are adequate responses. And so I think, for me, that role of rabbi at that point is to hold people on that bit of the journey that says it's okay to oscillate between control and submission, because it's through that oscillating world that you'll start to begin to see what you can take control of.
So, Mark, one of the things is that you see people, patients, who in some ways are too much in control and in some ways not enough in control. Tell me about how you see that people trying to take control as being not necessarily a good thing to start with.
So I totally agree with Miriam that it can feel nice to believe that one is in control and actually to do something, but it's potentially a trap and it's potentially deceptive. So constantly setting goals that you repeatedly can't achieve, that's actually not helpful. That's the royal road to depression. And so relinquishing that kind of control and that goal setting, or taking control in a different kind of, I'm not doing that. I'm dropping an A-level. I'm not going for the promotion. I'm not trying to achieve everything all at the same time. It's a kind of relinquishing control or taking control in another way. For other people, there's a kind of short-term relief of being in control. There's a famous family therapy textbook about eating disorders in which this little boy was forced to eat a lot by his parents because they were obsessed with him eating a lot. And the only bit of control that he could exercise was say, okay, I'll have dessert first, and then the main course, and then the starter. And that gave him a little bit of agency. Did the penny drop for his parents that he needed more agency? I hope so, although the book never told us that. But probably, Abigail, you're wondering about the mental health problem in which control is just such a massive feature, anorexia nervosa. And for many young people that I saw, they would start with low mood and then dieting would make them feel better, but not better enough. So they would control their diet even more and lose more weight and still not feel better. So they'd control it even more and lose even more weight. And then they would come for help because they were now in a panic. What they thought they were in control of, their eating, was now in control of them, and they couldn't break this. So there's some areas in which taking control, it could go fine. It could lead you into something much more complicated.
I think that's really true. So as a rabbi, how does religion respond to the feeling of out of control?
Well, I think religion's the like original framework of humankind's need to feel that sense of being in control, right? Even in the most primitive societies, people were trying to make sense of why sometimes, you know, the seas were stormy and sometimes the seas were calm, or sometimes your crops flourished and you could feed your family for that the coming months, and sometimes they failed. And actually that very basic level of understanding one's own part in that, and being able to say, well, maybe my behavior is what's causing the stormy seas or the crops to fail, is part of creating that sense of, I must be able to play my part here. And I think our Yom Kippur liturgy, for instance, is a really beautiful way of being able to kind of recognize that we still need a little bit of that in our life, a little bit of that sense of, by thinking about the role I play, perhaps that changes the external factors as well. So, you know, we'll beat our chests on Yom Kippur and say, you know, Ashamnu Bagadnu, we'll recite our sins, even though they're not necessarily the sins of each individual, but that sense of this is what I've done wrong. And then, you know, Salach Lanu, Mechal Lanu, Kapel Lanu, please, you know, pardon us, forgive us, turn this kind of uncontrollable world into something that I can face up to. And we've got that kind of sense of, if I play my part, then I'll be back in control, things will go well for me, with this other sort of beautiful sense of, I'm really nothing, I'm just a speck of dust, I'm clay in the hands of the potter, I'm sheep passing before a shepherd's staff, that really I'm just the child in the parental relationship, or you know, I'm nothing compared to the world around me. And it gives us that kind of safety net of what it means to not be in control and to kind of feel a bigger picture. This, I don't understand it. There's something bigger than me going on here, and therefore just submit to it and let it happen.
So do you think religion then has been created by us to explain our lack of control, or to give us a false sense that we do have control?
You know, for me, one of the most important things that religion gives us is that connection to an understanding that humanity hasn't really changed as much as we think it has. And from the beginning of time, we've been asking the same questions. And perhaps religion tells us as much about the questions we all need to ask as it does about the answers to those questions. You know, we think we live in a scientific age, and yet all of those questions that we've been asking about how we came to be, how the world came to be, actually, they're still some of our biggest questions in life. And I think not feeling that religion has Davka, the answer, the truth, the guiding, it gives you guiding principles. And most importantly, it gives you space to ask the big questions. And I think space to ask the questions is as comforting as answers that sometimes work for you and sometimes feel frustrating.
So that's very interesting. So Mark, you come from a different place where you're actually trying to help people get better. I'm using air commas there. And part of that is people feeling like they have control of their own mental health. How do you work that through with them?
Or sometimes accepting that they don't have control of their mental health. And I learned a lot from some Thai doctors who came to work with us at the Royal Free, and we asked them how Buddhism affects their practice as clinicians and how it affects the community. And they said it's pretty obvious, really. If your mood's been low and today your mood is better, you don't say to yourself, my depression's over, or I've nailed it, or anything like that. Just today is a better day. And if tomorrow's not such a good day, you don't agonize about whether or not you've had a relapse. Today's not such a good day. And I found that incredibly liberating. And where, to me as a psychiatrist, where religion comes in is this sense of purpose and part of being something greater. And sometimes coping with one's depression is also kind of part of being something greater, because so many people have it and everybody's got to learn to live with it in their own way. But we can't, it's not something we're ever going to be able to abolish. It's out there. People are going to be having depression, various other things, and having a personal and a communal sense of living with it is helpful. What I think is so challenging, though, is catastrophe and why me, and what on earth kind of purpose that can be part of. You know, if you're playing in the garden with a sibling and you kick the football into the road and your sibling goes into the road to get it for you, I won't finish the story. Why me? Why me? Why did this happen to me? What purpose could that possibly be part of? I think that is, talking to people about purpose there would be pretty insulting and hurtful, I would have thought.
But I wonder if there's some comfort in they've gone to a better place and we would love them to be here with us. But I wonder if at that point religion doesn't tell you why it happened, but the fact that it has happened allows you both the comfort of people around you to support you and give you community at that time, and a sense of, you know, please God, they're in a better place and we'll never know.
Yeah, and that helps some people, but for many people, that's a very long journey, and they haven't got there while they're still within the age group in which I work. Yeah, absolutely. But can we help them get there, away from the shrink's office and the rabbi's office and the place of worship? It's worth trying.
So if I came to you or we come to you with a mental health problem, would you say we couldn't take control of it?
I think it comes back to the sophist aphorism, to try to control that which you can and let go of that which you cannot, and to learn the distinction between the two. So you know, at a very simple level, if you're stressed, you're not going to sleep well. I mean, you might sleep a bit better with some help, but if there's a 6-month stressor in your life, you're probably not going to sleep very well in that 6 months. So you let go of trying to sleep that well. If you know, with my patients who've been at school, if it's a time where you're going to underperform academically, let go of some A levels. Change your see if you can. It's easy to say, but change your aspirations a bit and have aspirations that you can achieve. So what is the agency that one can have within the bigger picture where you temporarily don't have nearly as much control as you would like? And everybody, I think, likes to find some agency.
But that's really interesting, of finding control outside of you. What about trying to find the internal control?
Well, the cornerstone of cognitive psychology is to say, it's not what happens to you that matters, it's how you think and feel about it. And they do talk as though we can always control that. I think it's a good notion to have that we could try. I'm not sure we always can.
But is trying and failing better than not trying at all?
Well, trying and failing repeatedly is profoundly disheartening. And so, you know, if you're trying to do that yourself through a self-help manual, or your therapist trying to do that with you, that's not working. It's, in the early days, he used to talk about, so list all the things that are hard for you, list them from easiest to hardest, 1 to 10, 10 is the hardest. Okay, let's work on number 3, worth doing, but not an impossible challenge. And when we've worked on number 3, we might try number 6, but you don't go for number 9 or number 10.
Right.
Because you've got a good chance of failing and getting disheartened.
absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, in our society at the moment, particularly, there's a lot of emphasis, isn't there, on do we control our own bodies? Not just our minds, but do we control, and where does, you know, what, and where does control and free will, where are the borders? Miriam, you're nodding. What do you think about that?
Well, I think I'm just fascinated that I think society's always evolving that question, and what makes the kind of interesting topics of conversation at any one time is where that evolution is taking us in terms of what boundaries we're looking at in order to control, either control, you know, others for society, for societal purposes. And I wonder if kind of public opinion in that is at an all-time high, in terms of dictating where that kind of process goes, because their voices are being able to be heard in discussions that perhaps at a time might have been in the newspapers, but you wouldn't have been hearing the public response so clearly to it. So, you know, for instance, if we take just certain stories that are out there at the moment, so Sara Sharif, the little girl who was killed by her father and his partner, you know, it's clear that more children will be taken away from their parents and put into care because of the anxiety of social workers who will be scared to repeat not only the horror and the tragedy of that story, but also being on the receiving end of kind of public opinion of you failed her. You know, how is this possible? You failed her. And it might be that children who would have been perfectly safe with their parents will be taken away. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't be or they should be. I'm just saying the way that we have conversations nowadays means that I think that kind of sense of who takes control of society, of people's lives, shifts because of kind of how conversations are had out there. So, you know, I just read Best of Minds, a wonderful book that Mark recommended to me. And a really fascinating story about, you know, should those with schizophrenia be allowed to refuse treatment? And then almost just as soon as I'd finished the book, the Southport stabbings happened, and one of the narratives around how that tragedy was able to unfold, and how a clearly very ill man was able to walk into a building and commit such atrocities, was because at some point he had said, I won't be medicated, I'm needle phobic, and therefore you can't give me this medication. You know, again, public opinion all of a sudden is going to be in a very different position in terms of whether he should have been made to have had that that medication or not. So I think these stories that grab the public's attention, often because they are just the most tragic and the most awful, often are part of those evolutionary moments of how society differently sees its role in controlling the individual.
So Mark, you're obviously at the sharp end quite often of having to give people medication or treatment that they really don't want. How does that affect them, and how does that affect you?
Fortunately, I'm not at the very sharp end that Miriam was describing, and I don't know how people make those decisions about predicting risk. My decisions are simpler, and the judgments are simpler. I was just thinking, I'll come back to the bigger ones in a moment, but I was thinking about what Miriam was saying about society changing in a sense of control. So we can all now hold in our hands a thing that allows us to look at our finances and control them, to control our level of activity, to get any book that we want instantly and read it. It's great. What we can't control is how much we use this thing that gives us control. And sometimes it feels like it's controlling us. And if we don't feel that, sometimes the people we live with are pretty convinced that it's controlling us. So the thing that gives us control controls us and also spies on us. It's a mixed blessing. The feeling of control often comes with a mixed blessing. So why do I segue into that before coming to sometimes the sharp end of what doctors and other clinicians have to do. The law requires us to detain people against their will if they're at serious risk of harming themselves or somebody else. But it's an exquisitely painful thing, and it doesn't always feel like an altruistic thing. It can feel pretty mean at the same time. And especially if the person really, really, really doesn't have an inkling of sense of why it might be necessary. And I felt very grateful to those young people who have seen why this was necessary and even felt relief because the decision had been taken off them and someone else was mandating them to have treatment and they were now going to have it. And not everybody's like that, but some people were grateful. They kind of knew deep down, not very deep down, they needed treatment. They couldn't let themselves decide. They were grateful that somebody else was making the decision for them.
So there's a feeling of quiet satisfaction that you're doing the right thing, or is it quite traumatic for the nurses and the doctors?
Doing restraints is very, very traumatic. But a young woman who needed nasogastric feeding and was very clear that she wasn't going to have it unless she was detained under the Mental Health Act. And then she had this mantra that she had to repeat, I'm only going to let you do it because the decision's been taken out of my hands. And then she let it happen. And that was because the iron grip of anorexia, that if she kind of wasn't true to the cause, then she was in a very difficult battle of guilt with her own anorexia. But if the decision was taken away and she could repeat that over and over, she would then allow the tube to be passed and a life to be saved. Sounds complicated. I hope it's not confusing. It makes sense if you work in the field.
No, what's interesting is what you're saying is people, you're seeing people who don't want to get better, but Miriam, you're seeing people who are in a bad way, but they do want an answer. Or do you think they don't on some level too?
No, I think that we live in a world where often kind of societal structures feel very utilitarian, right? It's all about the greatest good for the greatest number. And so, you know, the NHS is a good example of that, of, you know, what are we able to prescribe and what can't we prescribe? Who do we treat and who don't we treat? You know, on the one level, we want to be treating everybody, but on the other level, we know we've only got a certain restricted funds and therefore those things seem fine on paper. When you're the person that's being refused the treatment, we all have a very different stance. You know, when I look back, back in 2000, my mum was diagnosed with cancer and was told there's no treatment, there's nothing we can do, you've got months left. You know, as a family, that wasn't an answer for us. We went out, this is, you know, the early days of the internet, we were busy researching, found a doctor in Boston who said, well, if she was here, this is what I'd do. And kind of, you know, made that demanding, this is the treatment you need to give her. And, you know, she had another 3 years, right? In those 3 years, she saw her first grandchild being born. She knew that a second one was on its way. You know, I wouldn't give up those few years. Those 3 years were hard for her. It was horrible treatment and, you know, but I guess it came with a bit of hope and it came with those big landmark moments. I think there's about society and the boundaries it creates, which need to be about everybody and how we as individuals push those boundaries, because ultimately when there's terrible things going on that we feel out of control of, we'll do anything we can to take back some of that control.
And what about prayer?
Prayer is, I think, a wonderful way of being able to put into words or to be given someone else's words of what it really is that ultimately we want. And I think prayer is kind of, it's difficult to use one term. You know, Judaism gives us a kind of responsibility to pray in community, which takes the individual prayer and makes it communal prayer. So we can all pray for world peace We can all pray for the things that matter to each of us, to everybody. And then there's that personal prayer, our own thoughts, what's important to me as an individual, which I think the space in services gives people to really think about kind of their own agency. What do I need? What support am I looking for? Ultimately, what is the goal? Is it getting better? Is it being allowed to go? Is it about just being able to relinquish responsibility and control? You know, people talk about manifesting as something all very modern and all in the well-being field. I think there's something about that's really been prayer's role for a very long time. If we talk about having healthy bodies, if we talk about world peace, is there something about that shared language that takes steps into bringing this into being?
So how do you see prayer helping us as individuals then, on an individual level?
I think it's about that space of acknowledgement of we're very rarely given time to really articulate what is going wrong. What are all of these feelings that are, you know, why is my heart racing and my shoulders up around my ears? Actually, on a Friday afternoon, evening, I get to sit in shul and stop and work out why my shoulders are up around my ears and my heart's racing, and actually be able to say, is it going to be different tomorrow or on Monday? How do I want to be? How do I want to take control? I also think, you know, I did my rabbinic dissertation on prayers for healing. And for me, it came at a time where, you know, I would sit in shul and next to my brother, they were newfangled in those days. They'd just been adopted really from the American Reform Movement, and they were being put into services in the UK. And he'd just sit next to me and like growl, kind of, you know, they don't work. I don't know why you're joining in, kind of thing. And it took me to do my dissertation, therefore, on, well, do they work? Like, what is this about? And actually, I feel one of their greatest powers is a call to action for the community. What does it mean to have your name or someone else's name shared in that space? And what's your responsibility as a member of the community when you hear it?
Yeah. Tricky one for you then, Mark. What about prayer in a therapeutic context?
Ooh, well, it's multiply tricky. We aren't allowed to recommend it. It's an absolute taboo within the health service to recommend prayer. And somebody got disciplined for offering to pray for one of their patients. So it's very, very tricky. But I see patients with a variety of faiths. And I suppose what I'm always struck by is what it brings them in terms of purpose. Which makes their lives a bit easier and makes my job easier. And I was thinking about your mom, Miriam, and she was offered no choice, and the family constructed a choice for her. And I think it is so essential if you're a service user or a patient to have a choice. And sometimes, you know, services are quite good at choices. So a dad, I used to see a single dad, had prostate cancer, and he wanted to maximize longevity over potency. So he had a radical prostatectomy. And the options were laid out to him, and he chose a heavy kind of choice, but he wanted to live longer. And it is so important to give people with any kind of illness or health issue a choice. And if prayer is part of their choice, fantastic. But the tricky thing is we're not allowed to recommend that one because life is too complicated for that. But if anything that any one of my patients is ever doing that is legal, affordable, and helpful, go for it, please.
So part of what you're doing from Wellspring is about well-being. So what, as well as prayer, which is one of the things I suppose you'll look at, what other kind of techniques do you think for well-being and feeling that control, being able to either take control or feel like you can understand control is part of it?
Right. Well, you know, I've been fascinated by some of the stories that have been coming out of Israel from the hostages when they have been released, and hearing from some of the more secular hostages who when in captivity, kind of found themselves resorting to counting the days, being aware of when it was Shabbat, of praying each kind of morning and night, practices, Jewish practices that in their kind of secular Israeli world were not part of their day-to-day, but in that extreme and, you know, horrific circumstance, that actually that's what they found strength in and that's what they needed. And so I think it's that reminder of, particularly in a more secularized society and in a world where perhaps a lot of that is not something that we see as a kind of an obligatory framework. Sometimes when we take back the framework, there's an understanding of what it means to give it its space and enable it to kind of hold one at difficult times. I was really struck, we've just finished our first course of our support groups, which will be a big part of Wellspring's offering. And we had, you know, six really varied sessions on different well-being techniques and things that people could take. And one of the things that really has kind of been adopted by a lot of members of the groups are actually something as basic as the morning blessings, part of our liturgy, where they were invited to write their own translations. So take this kind of antiquated, you know, what does it mean to open the eyes of the blind, or to not have made me a man, or not have made me a woman? That's a good Freudian slip. And what does it mean to start each day when life is really at its hardest with that shift of mindset of what are our blessings? What am I grateful for this morning? What is working in this body that feels like it's not working? What are my blessings in a day that feels so hard and so difficult? And I think just that taking on of some of those, you know, ancient practices of prayer is actually something that can be much more affirming when times are difficult than we might have otherwise given it its place for, when it's just seen as a mantra that we just have to get through at certain times of the day or week.
So Mark can't officially endorse that, but I can see he probably quietly does. Is there anything else, well-being-wise, that either of you would like to leave our listeners with this episode?
I think Miriam was talking about hope when she was talking about prayer and what gives us hope. And I think hope is just such a fantastic stepping stone towards control, because if you have hope that you could recover, then you don't allow yourself to develop bed sores, you don't let everything go, you try to maintain certain things. If you don't have hope, well, things get worse. And we just have to be very, very careful as clinicians, as rabbis, as anyone of influence, always been trying to give people hope wherever possible, and hoping, if I may say so, never to find oneself in a circumstance where it just isn't worth having hope anymore, because that's...
We have to end with Rabbi Hugo Grin's most famous quote when commenting on his father melting their precious margarine ration in the concentration camp that they were being held in together in Hanukkah during the Shoah, where his dad reminds him, we've learned that we can live almost 3 weeks without food, 3 days without water, but we know we can't live 3 minutes without hope.
So with that, we hope you have a good few days, weeks, months, and we hope you find hope and a little bit of control, and we hope to connect with you again in the future.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.